Thank you. जय 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 श्री जय जय
ज्ञानाधिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपा कदा मह्यं कदापि स्वापदान्तिकम् वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरो श्रीयुतावरकमलं श्रीगुरुन् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातं सहगणा रघुनाथान्वितं तं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनासहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपादां सहगणा ललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च हे कृष्णा करुणा सिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिकाकांत राधाकांत नमोस्तुते तप्त कांचन गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरि प्रिये वांछाकल्पारुभ्यश्च कृपा सिंधुभ्यैव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
सो वंस अगेन वेलकम टू this seminar. I forget the exact title of the seminar.
Essence of all advice.
Wow, okay, that's a pretty demanding title, The Essence of All Advice. We can give the essence of all advice. It's not a problem, because of course it won't be done on our own strength, but on the strength of someone who was quite clear about the essence of all advice, had experienced it himself, and was qualified to explain it to others. And the topic, more specifically, I guess, is on the book called Sri Upadesham, translated by Srila Prabhupada as The Nectar of Instruction. And I'll be drawing primarily from the Nectar of Instruction in this seminar, although it won't be a kind of summary study of the entire book. It's not going to be a Bhakti Shastri type systematic study of the book. That would take much longer than the time we have, and it's also kind of a different type of study. What we're going to do here is rather take specific themes that are discussed by Srila Rupa Goswami, the author of Upadeshamrita, at various points in the book, and do studies of those themes. So, for example, we'll look at the topic of sense control and creating boundaries for ourselves. We'll look at the theme of determination, and how crucial that is to our Krishna conscious life. And we'll look at the topic of relationships with devotees. I'll highlight the dangers of over endeavor as a impediment or a problem for those who are pursuing the path of devotional service, and so on. So we'll be taking specific themes that are grounded in the nectar of instruction without making an attempt to be comprehensive, to do everything, because that would be very difficult over today and part of tomorrow. So that's kind of our basic approach, and I'll be doing most of the talking, although this afternoon my brother will be giving one session on the theme of determination. He's got a nice study of determination and its relationship to fall down, and how these two things can work together or work against each other. And so he'll be discussing that theme probably sometime after lunch today. So that's the overall format of the seminar. And the first theme that I want to discuss this morning is going to be the theme of boundaries and regulation, because this is the theme that Rupa Goswami chooses to begin his Upadeshamrita with, his nectar of instruction. But before we do that, a little bit about the book and the author himself. I remember one time when I was studying in Oxford, we had a Sanskrit teacher come in from India. His name was Acharya Sanskritananda Hari, a very learned person. His very name incorporated knowledge of Sanskrit in it. His name was Sanskritananda, one who is experiences the bliss of the Sanskrit language. And he came specifically to teach us spoken Sanskrit. And at some point near the end of our week of classes, he said, okay, now, Ravi, why don't you, as I'm usually known in the academic world, he said, why don't you tell me the story of Lord Ramachandra in Sanskrit? Just the basic outline. Try saying something. So I tried to put together everything I'd learned, and I knew Sanskrit already, but to speak it is something very different. As you may know from learning a foreign language, to be able to read and write it is one thing. To be actually speak it is speaking is the last thing. Is the first thing a child learns when the language is the mother language, and it's the last thing you pick up when you're learning a language as a second language or a third language. So it's a little more difficult. Anyhow, so I started off something like Asid Raja Rama Nama. There was once a king named Rama. And so on. He was the son Dasharatha Suto and like that. And I barely got to the second line of my sentence, and he stopped me, and he said, no, this is not how you do it. You can't do it. And I said, why, what's wrong? Did I get the grammar wrong, or was the structure of the sentence? He said, no, the approach is wrong. He said, you can't start the story of Rama by just saying, there was a king named Rama, and he was the son of Dasharatha, and one day he went off and married Sita. This is not some kind of novel you're telling, or some fairy tale. This is the story of the Supreme Lord. This is Lord Ramachandra. And it's no ordinary story. How can you tell the Lord's pastimes, his Leela, without first receiving his blessings? Who has the power to properly tell the Lord's activities without receiving the blessings of the Lord? In order to receive those blessings, you need to first glorify him before you start diving into the Ramayana itself. And in fact, this is how the Ramayana begins. If you read Valmiki Ramayana, Valmiki is asking his spiritual master Narada Muni that if there's one person who's the most perfect in this world, who's the ideal person, who would that be? And Narada Muni goes on to extol the glories of Rama, his virtues in every way. So that's the way to begin. So it was a humbling moment for me, because it was embarrassing to be stopped like that. Here I was thinking, oh, I know Sanskrit, I can tell this. It's obviously simple stories, they're just the Ramayana. And we all grow up knowing the story of the Ramayana. And yet he completely found it unacceptable, right, because of this point. And so I always try to remember that since then, before beginning any kind of devotional telling or lecture. Who are we talking about? And why are they worthy of hearing about? Why are they worthy of glorification? And so keeping in that same mode, the author in the book here, Rupa Goswami, and then Nectar of Instruction, why is it worth hearing? Why is it worth focusing on? It's a very important thing to begin with. Because there's no end to how much we can dive into that aspect, into the glories of a Vaishnava, even if we think we know who they actually are and their basic history and so forth. It's very important in order to receive blessings. Okay? And nothing happens in this world without proper blessings. So, one of the things that is remarkable about Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement, and this is something that is well known not just amongst devotees, but also accepted amongst scholars of our tradition, those who are not devotees but who spend a lot of time studying it. Namely, that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement somehow attracted a very sophisticated following, a very qualified, a very elite following during his time and afterwards as well. The amount of noble, respectable people who joined Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement is disproportionate to the size of the movement. In terms of looking at the history of religion and the history of Hinduism in India, in terms of the numbers, right? It's relatively small. Gaudiya Vaishnavas, I don't know how many actually, but if you count those who are born in Gaudiya Vaishnava families as well as those of us who practice it as a result of meeting devotees, maybe, I don't know, 3-4 million people. So it sounds, it's a large number, but relatively speaking, you know, 6 billion people in the world, small. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement attracted a disproportionately large number of very, very learned, very educated, very sophisticated people. Just take a moment to think about all the names, the big names, you know, from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's own time and after him. Someone give me some names of famous devotees, acharyas. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, Vishwanath Chakravarti, Ramananda Raya, Keshav Bharati, Haridas Thakur, Narottam Das Thakur,
Srila
Prabhupada, right? You look at every single one of these devotees, they were the cream of their societies, of their time. They were the type of people who, even if they did not become devotees, they would have been respected and honored in any audience they went into. This is Srinivas Acharya, he describes this in his beautiful Shat Goswami Ashtaka. He says, the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, Tyaktva Turna Mashesha Mandalapati Shenin Sadatu Chavat, that these Goswamis of Vrindavan, they were Mandalapati. They were the masters of their mandalas. Mandala means circle, right? Their social circle. We use that word in English too. Social circle. So, in terms of their social circle, one time I read a quotation, a set of quotations about what success means. And one that stuck out in my mind was it said, success means to be well respected amongst your peers. That circle, that mandala in which you operate, and which you want to operate, if those people respect you well, that's considered success. Because there's no one in this world who's respected in every circle, or who's even known in every circle. Right? So you might be the best in your field, and you walk into another area, and you're nobody. Right? So success is measured, I forget the name of the person who said this, but is being well respected in your mandala, in your circle. So these Goswamis, they were mandalapati. They were the leaders, the rulers of their social circles. And they were respected everywhere they went. You look at persons like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. You know Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya? His official name is Vasudeva Sarvabhauma. And he was the head priest, pundit, a scholar, in the court of Maharaj Prataparudra, who was the Gajapati king of Orissa at that time. And his works, before he joined the Hare Krishna movement, right, the books that he wrote at that time are still studied today by scholars as important works of nyaya, of navya nyaya, of logic, of the type of dry logic that we always read about devotees spitting at in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Oh, the dry logic of, you know, even he says later on, he says, I spent my whole life eating the dry oil cakes of logic, of nyaya. And now, he says to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you have given me nectar to drink of Amrita, Krishna Katha. So all those dry oil cakes of knowledge that he was eating and producing and making others eat, right? Those books that he wrote before he became a follower of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu are still studied by scholars as classics in the tradition of Navya Nyaya. So when he became a devotee, this made waves all over the country, all over India, because of who he was. And so the point is, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement attracted mandalapatis, leaders of their social circles. It also, of course, attracted everyone else. That's a fact. And there's one beautiful purport in Srimad Bhagavatam in which Prabhupada says that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu specialized in preaching to the elite section of society, and Nityananda Prabhu specialized in preaching to everyone, to the general populace. In this way, they captured the entire world. They captured everyone. So the Krishna consciousness movement, of course, is for everyone. But for our purposes here, this point I'm trying to highlight about how what significant persons these Goswamis of Vrindavan were. Shreni, they had immensely high positions. So Rupa Goswami and his elder brother Sanatana Goswami, as most of us will know, they came from South Indian Brahmin families from Karnataka. Their family, several generations before them, had moved to Bengal. And they had been coerced into the service of the Nawab of Bengal, the Muslim ruler at that time. As a result, they had taken on titles that were appropriate to their work. Dabir Khas and Sakhar Malik. Basically, they held the position of Prime Minister and Chief of the Treasury. Chief of the Treasury. Prime Minister and Chief of the Treasury. this title of Dabir Khas, okay, which was Rupa Goswami's title, is basically third in power from the Nawab himself. Okay, so you have the Nawab, who is the king or the head of the kingdom. By the way, the Nawab of Bengal was especially powerful. Bengal was one of the richest and most powerful kingdoms in that period of Mughal rule in North India. The evidence for this is seen even later with the British. The British came and were especially attracted to Calcutta, set up their first capital there and started trade there and so forth. This was a very rich, very prosperous section and very powerful kingdom in India. So the Nawab already was a very powerful man. Then below that, you have the prime minister, you could say. And then below that, you have the chief secretary, Dabir Khas. The Nawab was basically delegated all the work about ruling the kingdom to the prime minister. Okay, and the position of Dabir Khas was a stepping stone to the position of prime minister. Often, the person who was in that position of Dabir Khas would move up to the position of prime minister. And then, often, the prime minister, through staging a coup or some kind of unjust or upside-down means, he'd pull down the Nawab and become the Nawab himself. So this was often the trajectory of power. The point being that this was someone, Rupa Goswami was someone, Sanatana Goswami, these were people who knew what it meant to be successful in this world. Sometimes people have a way of looking at scripture and saying, oh, you know, it's written by sages and munis, and what do they know about the real world? And what do they know about our problems? How can they give practical advice? They've controlled their senses, they're sitting in a forest as sages, and they've got no cares in this world. Or perhaps they don't know what success means. like I know what success is. No. This is someone who knew what it meant to be successful and who knew what it meant to be a leader in society. Who knew what it meant to lead. It was no ordinary position. And had he stuck with that position, he could have climbed to the position at least of Prime Minister. Probably not Nawab, because it was the wrong religion. But at least Prime Minister. He could have moved up to pretty much the most powerful position in the land at that time. That was the career path he was on, so to speak. If we think of our own career paths, where we're heading and what the sacrifices we make for that, this is someone like that. But tyaktva turna mashesha mandalapati shrinim sada tuchavat. They gave all this up, tuchavat, like it was useless, like it was just garbage on the street. They just rejected it. Why? Gopi bhavar samritabdi lahari kallon magnom bhul. They had something much, much more delicious to taste, to experience. And that was the gopi bhava, the immense emotions, the deep emotions that come as a result of love for Krishna in the mood of the residents of Vrindavan. And so they gave all of this up. So what it means to say that here's someone who can give the essence of all advice. This is why saying this is the essence of all advice is not too precocious a claim for someone like this. Because this is someone who experienced what this world had to offer, went through it all, was a success, was a leader, and then decided that he had something better. So it behooves us to pay attention to what he's got to offer. Just like that story of that man who came to Sanatan Goswami looking for the touchstone. And Sanatan Goswami said, oh, it's I think I put it there, in that pile there, which was a refuse pile, a garbage pile. And the man was really excited, pulled it out. But then he had a little intelligence, and he said, well, if this man is keeping a touchstone in his garbage pile, then he must have something far more valuable with himself, right? Because you only keep that which is least valuable in a pile or in a garbage dump. So you must have more valuable things with you. So that was their move. This is we've got something far more valuable than that. So Rupa Goswami, along with the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, all of them together, they took the cream of their experience, what they had learned through life in this world, and wrote that, taught it for the benefit of others. They gave up their own work to teach, to give that benefit, the benefit of their experience to others. And boy, did they write. They wrote altogether 1 million verses in Sanskrit. 1 million verses. That's the count that Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami gives us in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Now just think about what 1 million verses means. What's the longest book in the world? Mahabharata. How many verses is it? 100,000 verses. How many people have read the Mahabharata cover to cover? Just one person here. One person. And watching the television serial over and over doesn't count. For all its life, the 60 hours or whatever, it doesn't even scratch the surface of what's in the Mahabharata. Imagine, they wrote 10 times that amount together, 1 million verses in Sanskrit. They wrote a lot. Oh. Now, what you want to ask someone like that is, what I would want to ask someone like that is, okay, clearly you can write a lot. Clearly you can talk a lot. Clearly you've got a lot to say, you're very learned. But I don't have a time to read 1 million verses, nor do I have the capability to understand them all. Okay? So if you had to summarize them, put them all in a nutshell, in one small nutshell, would you be able to do that for me? This is a question frequently asked of academics also, because professors have a tendency to go on and on and on and on and keep talking and talking and talking. And they know so much, and they need an audience. And so you put them in front of a captive audience, like students, for example, whose grades depend on listening to what the professor says. And the only saving grace the students have is the 50-minute limit to the period, to the class period. They go on and on and on. And then they come together in conferences, like the American Academy of Religion conference, and there's no limit to the, and they go on and on and on to each other. And each person is listening to the other person only to find the right point to cut in so that they can start talking. That's the main purpose of listening attentively, is to find that break, which is difficult to find, actually, to find that break where you can jump in with your own brilliant comments. So, this is, okay, you know a lot, clearly, right? But can you actually make that practical? Can the Harvard professor actually teach someone who's a beginning student? That's the question. And the answer with Rupa Goswami is definitely yes. He's summarized the science of devotional service in a wonderful book called Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, The Nectar of Devotion, which is Prabhupada subtitles The Complete Science of Devotional Service. Exhaustive description. That is practically everything we need to pursue the devotional path. But even if we don't have full time for that, or we need something in a more digestible format, then he's written something called Upadeshamrita. Upadesha means instruction or advice. Advice. And Amrita means nectar or essence. So this is the essence of all advice. Upadeshamrita, the essence of all advice. And in just 11 verses, he summarizes everything. The entire science of bhakti. You start off in verse number 1 with someone who's still trying to control their urge to speak, to stop talking, to stop becoming angry unnecessarily, and so forth. And you end up in Radha Kunda with Srimati Radharani, experiencing the highest levels of love for Krishna in the mood of the gopis. In 11 verses, from here to there. That's how powerful it is, how much of an executive summary of bhakti it is. My spiritual master, Hanumat Preshaka Swami, he is fond of giving seminars, lectures on nectar of instruction. These are like 1-hour sessions, which he titles 5 Minutes with a Genius. Because it takes exactly 5 minutes to read through these verses, total. So here we have a genius with us, and we've got 5 minutes. Right? He's got 5 minutes to tell us everything there is to know. And he's done it. The essence of all advice, Upadeshamrita. And hopefully, in the course of this seminar, you'll get a little feel of just the depth of what's present there. Right? Because that's the nature of summaries. They're advantageous in one way, because you get everything in a short span. They're also difficult in another, because there's so much there that unless you know how to unpack it, how to withdraw it, how to dig it out, you could miss a lot. And so it goes both ways. And this is why it's so important to read Srila Prabhupada's purports along with it, because he draws it out. Right? He unpacks that. He extracts that nectar. It takes a little churning to do that. So what I thought we could do is just as a refresher for those of us who've read the book, and as an introduction for those who haven't, perhaps we could just read through the verses and the translations. You're welcome to follow along if you have a copy of the book. If you don't, then please listen. It's very nice to listen to these verses as well. Let's see. I encourage you to get a copy of the book early in the seminar if you don't have. I believe we have a few copies here.
We ran out.
Okay. So share with a neighbor if you don't have a copy. Shall we recite the verses together?
Yes.
That would be nice. So we'll recite the verses all together as a group, and then I'll just read the translation on my own after each verse. This is text number 1, on page 1.
Vacho vegam manasa krodha vegam
जिह्वा वेगम उदरुपस्थ वेगम एतां वेगान्यो विषभेद धीरा सर्वामपि मां पृथिवीं सृष्य.
A sober person who can tolerate the urge to speak, the mind's demands, the actions of anger, and the urges of the tongue, belly, and genitals is qualified to make disciples all over the world. Text number 2, which is a few pages down, so we have to flip here. Page 14.
अत्याहारप्रयासश्च प्रजल्पो नियमाग्रह जनसङ्गश्च लोयं च षड्भिर्भक्तिर्विनश्यति.
One's devotional service is spoiled when he becomes too entangled in the following six activities. 1. Eating more than necessary or collecting more funds than required. 2. Over-endeavoring for mundane things that are very difficult to obtain. 3. Talking unnecessarily about mundane subject matters. 4. Practicing the scriptural rules and regulations only for the sake of following them and not for the sake of spiritual advancement. Or rejecting the rules and regulations of the scriptures and working independently or whimsically. 5. Associating with worldly-minded persons who are not interested in Krishna consciousness. And 6. Being greedy for mundane achievements. Text number 3, which is on page 26.
Utsaha nishchaya dhairya tattat karma pravartana sangatyagat sato vritte shatbir bhakti prasiddhati.
There are 6 principles favorable to the execution of pure devotional service. Being enthusiastic, endeavoring with confidence, being patient, acting according to regulated principles, such as Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, hearing, chanting, and remembering Krishna, abandoning the association of non-devotees, and following in the footsteps of the previous acharyas. These 6 principles undoubtedly assure the complete success of pure devotional service. Okay, so here's some guidance. First 3 verses. Next couple of verses focus on association with devotees. Text number 4, this is page 38.
Dadati prati grihnati bhujyamakhyati prichyati bhunte bhojayate chaiva shabdhitam priti lakshanam.
Offering gifts and charity, accepting charitable gifts, revealing one's mind in confidence, inquiring confidentially, accepting prasad and offering prasad are the 6 symptoms of love shared by one devotee and another. The next one is in the same melody as Govindam prayers. Govindam.
Krishne diyasya giritam manasadriyeta dikshasti chetrana vidhishya bhajantam isham shushrushaya bhajana vignam ananyam anya nindari shunya vidami sita sangalahya.
One should mentally honor the devotee who chants the holy name of Lord Krishna. One should offer humble obeisances to the devotee who has undergone spiritual initiation, diksha, and is engaged in worshipping the deity. One should associate with and faithfully serve that pure devotee who is advanced in undeviated devotional service and whose heart is completely devoid of the propensity to criticize others. Text number 6. Same melody. Page 59.
Drishtai swabhava janitai vapushascha doshai na prakritatva miha bhakta janasya pashye ganga bhasam na khalu budbudabhena pankai brahma dravatva mapagachati nira dharmai.
Being situated in his original Krishna conscious position, a pure devotee does not identify with the body. Such a devotee should not be seen from a materialistic point of view. Indeed, one should overlook a devotee's having a body born in a low family, a body with a bad complexion, a deformed body, or a diseased or infirm body. According to ordinary vision, such imperfections may seem prominent in the body of a pure devotee, but despite such seeming defects, the body of a pure devotee cannot be polluted. It is exactly like the waters of the Ganges, which sometimes during the rainy season are full of bubbles, foam, and mud. The Ganges waters do not become polluted. Those who are advanced in spiritual understanding will bathe in the Ganges without considering the condition of the water. Okay. Text number 7, page 65.
Syat Krishna nama charitadi sitapya vidya pikto patapta rasanasya narochitanu kinvadaradanu dinam kalutaiva jushta svavigramadbhavati tadgadamulahante.
The holy name, character, pastimes, and activities of Krishna are all transcendentally sweet, like sugar candy. Although the tongue of one afflicted by the jaundice of avidya, ignorance, cannot taste anything sweet, it is wonderful that simply by carefully chanting these sweet names every day, a natural relish awakens within his tongue, and his disease is gradually destroyed at the root. And here comes the essence of all advice. The essence of the essence of all advice. Text 8.
Tannama rupa charitadi sukirtananu smrityo kramena rasanama nasini yojya tishthan vraje tadanuragya jananugami kalam nayeta iramityupadesha saram.
The essence of all advice is that one should utilize one's full time, 24 hours a day, in nicely chanting and remembering the Lord's divine name, transcendental form, qualities, and eternal pastimes, thereby gradually engaging one's tongue and mind. In this way, one should reside in Vraja, Goloka Vrindavan Dham, and serve Krishna under the guidance of devotees. One should follow in the footsteps of the Lord's beloved devotees, who are deeply attached to his devotional service.
Okay, now this next one, text 9, is in the melody of Shad Goswami Ashtaka. Okay?
Na 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 na. Vaikuntha janito vara madhupuri tatra pira sotsava Vrindaranya udara pani ramana tatra pi govardhana Radha kunda miha pi gokulapate prema mrita plavana Guryadasya viraja to giritate sevam viveki naka.
The holy place known as Mathura is spiritually superior to Vaikuntha. So here's a hierarchy of spiritual realms. The holy place known as Mathura is spiritually superior to Vaikuntha, the transcendental world, because the Lord appeared there. Superior to Mathura, Puri is the transcendental forest of Vrindavan because Krishna's Rasa Lila pastimes. Because of Krishna's Rasa Lila pastimes. And superior to the forest of Vrindavan is Govardhana Hill, for it was raised by the divine hand of Sri Krishna and was the site of his various loving pastimes. And above all, the super excellent Sri Radha Kunda stands supreme, for it is over flooded with the ambrosial nectarine prema of the Lord of Gokula, Sri Krishna. Where then is that intelligent person who is unwilling to serve this divine Radha Kunda, which is situated at the foot of Govardhan Hill? Two more. Same melody, text number 10.
Karmibhya parito hare priyataya vyaktim yayur jnanina sebhyo jnana vimukta bhakti parama
premaika nishasatha tibhyastha pashupala pankaja drishas tabhyo pisaradhika krishna tadvadhyam tadiya sahase tannashayekakviti.
And here is a hierarchy of worshippers of the Lord. In the Shastra, it is said that of all types of fruitive workers, he who is advanced in knowledge of the higher values of life is favored by the Supreme Lord Hari. Out of many such people who are advanced in knowledge, jnanis, one who is practically liberated by virtue of his knowledge may take to devotional service. He is superior to the others. However, one who has actually attained prema, pure love of Krishna, is superior to him. The gopis are exalted above all the advanced devotees because they are always totally dependent upon Sri Krishna, the transcendental cowherd boy. Among the gopis, Srimati Radharani is the most dear to Krishna. Her Kunda lake is as profoundly dear to Lord Krishna as this most beloved of the gopis. Who then will not reside at Radha Kunda? He's asking again. And in a spiritual body surcharged with ecstatic devotional feelings of Prakrita Bhava, render loving service to the divine couple, Sri Sri Radha Govinda, who perform their Ashtakaliya Lila, their eternal eightfold daily pastimes. Indeed, those who execute devotional service on the banks of Radha Kunda are the most fortunate people in the universe. And the very last verse about Srimati Radharani. Okay, this is yet another melody. Okay, so it's a little different here. It's the same melody as the verse "Gopi Bhartu Padakamalayo Dasa Dasani Das." That verse.
Krishnasyo chai pranaya vasiti preyase dhopi radha. Kundam chasya munibhiramitas tadrigeva vyadhai yat preshthairapyalamasulabham kim punar bhakti bhajam tat premedam sakidapisara snatura vishkaroti.
A little bit more detail. Of the many objects of favored delight and of all the lovable damsels of Rajabhumi, Srimati Radharani is certainly the most treasured object of Krishna's love. And in every respect, her divine kunda is described by great sages as similarly dear to him. Undoubtedly, Radha Kunda is very rarely attained, even by the great devotees. Therefore, it is even more difficult for ordinary devotees to attain. If one simply bathes once within those holy waters, one's pure love of Krishna is fully aroused. So how long did that take? More than 5, maybe 10, 15? Because we were reading translations too. If we were to read just the verses, it'd take 5 minutes. So, 5 minutes, an executive summary. 5 minutes with a genius. Srila Prabhupada, he said that as devotees, our role, our job, is to assist Hanumanji in his service to Lord Ramachandra. Basically, this entire material world is Krishna's energy, and yet it is being used separate from Krishna. Just like Mother Sita, who is the Lord's internal energy, was separated from Lord Ramachandra. And Hanuman decided to help the Lord by conveying his message to Mother Sita. Similarly, Srila Prabhupada asked us as devotees and preachers in this movement to convey Krishna's message to whomever we meet. Yare dekho tare kaho Krishna upadesh. But Hanumanji had a very useful tool, very useful, not just tool, item, to help evoke this remembrance in Mother Sita and to convince her that he was the real thing, the real messenger. What was that special item he had? The ring, right? The ring. The mudrika from Lord Ramachandra. Given by Lord Ram himself to to please give this to Mother Sita as evidence of their relationship, as a reminder, as evidence that Hanuman was coming from the right place. This nectar of instruction, this Upadeshamrita, is like that mudrika, is like that ring, right? That the Lord has given us, the devotees have given us. It's very small, just a little thing, right? It doesn't, just something so small as this, you think, wow, you know, how could, maybe he should have taken a book describing all of Lord Ram's activities, or should have taken something more substantial, or a piece of his clothing, or something. No, just something so tiny, right? And yet we all know how powerful this little thing is at evoking the deepest emotions in people. A wedding ring, and how crucial it can be. Right? That I don't want to lose this. Right? How much meaning it can have. Sometimes it's passed down through generations, right? From mother to daughter and so forth. And the same way, this is like that. Right? It's a little ring, just something very small, 11 verses, and yet it's packed full of emotion, packed full. It has the capability, if we hand this to someone, of evoking in them the highest levels of emotion for Krishna. Of course, it depends on the recipient as well. You know, Mother Sita was already meditating on Lord Ram directly. But nevertheless, it has that. It's packed into it. Right? Just like a mudrika, just like a ring. And so it's our job to, well, first of all, to give it to ourselves, to receive it ourselves, and evoke that emotion, that remembrance in ourselves, and then to give it to others. My spiritual master is very fond of giving this book as a gift to people everywhere he goes. He'll go to the airport and get checked in by the skycap and you're supposed to give a tip, and he keeps the copy in a little packet, in a little bag. You know, you've seen these little bags that you can buy in the gift shop, like this. One reason to go to the gift shop, get one of those bags, right? And the Nectar of Instruction fits perfectly in that bag. It's exactly the right size. And he'll keep it right here under his clothing, and he'll pull out the bag. And I saw him do this once, and he'll bring, dig in, he'll put it out. It looks like it's coming from his heart, which is where it's coming from, really. And he'll hand it to the person, sir, I'd like to give this to you. And, you know, it's not money, and you think, well, they'd become a little, oh, I've been cheated. But the way in which he offers it, with such love, the way Hanuman dropped that ring, coming straight from his heart, people think, wow, it must be something very valuable. He keeps it right here. Right? And they take it very, very nicely. They appreciate it a lot. It depends a lot on the quality of the messenger as well. And sometimes he'll leave a book in the front, in the seat pocket of the airplane with a note on it saying, this book is very valuable. If you find it, please write to me at... and he'll put his email address. And of course, some very... the only person who take the trouble to do that is someone who's already generous and kind by nature. And it's a nice way to initiate contact and say, actually, it's a really nice book, and I managed to get another copy, and you're welcome to keep that one. And it's wonderful. The person feels like they received a gift, they value it, even though there's no money exchanged in the whole encounter. This is the point. Something very small, yet packed full of meaning, and a very, very effective tool to recover our own relationship with the Lord and to help others recover our relationship. Okay, so now here beginneth our study. It's best to begin with the first verse. Vacho Vegam Manasa Krodha Vegam. This verse is quite famous. Rupa Goswami here talks about six types of urges that all of us encounter in this world, regardless of who we are, whether we're rich or poor, or old or young, or human or animal. All of us, regardless of our material situation, we all have to encounter six different kinds of pushes or urges in this world. And here, he basically describes three different kinds of urges. The urges of speaking, of the mouth, of the tongue, the urge of the mind, and the urges of the body. So words, this is called, how does it go? I forget the first word. Vapu, manasa, and kira. Mind, body, and words. These three things, aspects of our being. He says, one who is able to control the urge to speak, the mind's demands. Mind's demands means especially the attachments of the mind, the things we're attached to in this world. So one who's able to properly control the urge to speak, the attachments of the mind, the actions of anger, the tongue, the belly, and the genitals. He said that person is what? Qualified to do what? He's qualified to have disciples all over the world. So by the end of the first verse, if we imbibe this properly, and we understand this first verse properly, we're qualified to be spiritual masters. We're qualified to be gurus. This is how fast this book progresses. Right? End of first verse, you're guru. You're qualified to be an initiating spiritual master. Right? Next verse, okay, other things. This, in other words, you've already developed purity of body, mind, and words. Now, we don't have time to discuss each one of these at length. But let me just highlight a little bit here. Okay, let's just look at the first one here. Vachovegam, the urge to speak. How many leaders, how many great people do we know in the history of the world who have been made or broken simply because of something they said? Not too long ago, in a U.S. presidential election, there were two candidates competing for office. And one of them went up to give a speech, a talk. It was a debate-type situation, I believe. And then sat down, and the other guy went up. And when the other person went up, this first person whispered some kind of a racial slur or comment under his breath against the other candidate. I don't know the details of the story, whether I'm getting it right or not. But anyhow, what he didn't realize was that the lapel mic was still on, right? And everyone heard it, especially those who were listening carefully, namely the media, newspapers and television. Pretty soon it was on every newspaper, television station, everywhere, right? And it was one of the turning points of his campaign, one of the things that led to the damage, did considerable damage to his campaign. If you look at our current president, it all started with a brilliantly wonderful speech that he gave at the Democratic primaries. He was practically a nobody, you know, just small. And the power of speech, very, very powerful. A small thing said, one word you say can make someone's day, it can ruin their life. Just a sentence we say, it's so powerful. More powerful than the sword is the power of speech. And a leader is someone who has the ability to control that speech and use it effectively. What Rupa Goswami is given here in this verse is basically the definition of a leader. If we could describe it more broadly. It's put specifically in the term of shishya, or that person is qualified to have disciples all over the world. But the word shishya in Sanskrit just means someone who is to be guided or instructed, someone who is to be led. So if you look at this from a business perspective, for example, a manager or leader who has the ability to use their words in a measured and carefully channeled way, who has the ability to control their anger, who has the ability to resist the urge of the mind of attachment and of the tongue, belly, and genitals, that person, he's saying, is qualified to have employees all over the world. They can be the head of the world's greatest multinational corporation, and they'll be respected and they'll be honored. These are universal principles of leadership. Of course, here we're interested in how they're applicable to spiritual life. But any of these six, you can read any kind of management book and leadership book, and they all talk about these very six things. Someone who's able to control, to properly channel these six things. We also know of U.S. presidents who are brought down because of the inability to control the lower urges, right? The genital. These things are present everywhere. Srila Prabhupada, he describes how these three things, they come in a straight line. The tongue, the belly, the genitals, and hell. Right? They all come in a straight line. Anything we do, our careers, materially, our careers spiritually, can go straight to hell if we don't know how to control these six urges. And if we know how to control them and use them properly, okay, then there's no limit to what we can accomplish in life. Now, one question that often people ask in today's society, after reading a verse like this, control the urge to speak, control your attachments, control anger, control this, control that, control your hunger, control the desire to taste good things. Isn't this a formula for a repressed individual? Isn't this describing someone who is going to be repressed and depressed and oppressed their whole life? Right? I mean, how can you go through life putting a lid on all of these things? Often we tend to think of, even in educating children, for example, this is a common question, is how much should you tell your children not to do things? And how much should you control them? How much should you stop them? Or how much should you let them explore and do things on their own, to kind of a self-learning process? And let them, kind of learn on their own through life's experiences. Isn't this setting someone up to become a mentally unstable individual? The reason we ask questions, we're concerned about this, is because this type of idea, this question, is born from a certain concept of human psychology, of what human beings are. And that concept basically says the human mind is like a pressure cooker. You put a lid on it, you close it up, you put the little whistle on top, and you turn on the heat. The heat is always on. This is the world. Right? The heat is always on. And we're like the pressure cooker. And if you let the pressure build, vacho vegam manasa krodha vegam, you stifle this urge and you stifle that urge and you stifle this urge and so forth, then one day, what's going to happen? The pressure cooker is going to explode. And that's not a good scene. That's not very good. So, therefore, the solution is that you have to let off steam every once in a while. Right? Yes, repress your sexual urges, but every once in a while, let go. It's normal to have an affair once in a lifetime. It's normal to... It's okay, right? This type of conception, it comes from many different places, but especially Freudian psychology. The famous psychologist, Freud, Sigmund Freud. He says human beings are like that. Right? We're basically pressure cookers. We've got this whole churning world inside of us. Society... is the lid on the pressure cooker. Right? It puts the lid and says, no, you've got that urge to steal that beautiful piece of jewelry sitting there. Don't do it. Why? Because you could get caught and then you could go to prison. But if society weren't there, you'd go ahead and steal it. Right? If you knew you didn't have consequences. Every person would steal something valuable if they knew there were no consequences. Why? Because that's our nature. And society is a pressure cooker. It's the lid on the pressure cooker. And therefore, we have to let off steam. This is important, to remain a healthy individual. Sometimes we can subscribe to this kind of viewpoint without even realizing it. Right? We may not have studied Freud, we may not even think very highly of Freud, but we may still actually believe in many of what Freud thinks, because this is what we're taught in this society. This is the mode of thinking. This is the common kind of approach to human psychology. But Vedic literature gives an alternative to this. It says, Why should we think of the mind as a pressure cooker? Why? Instead, why don't we think of the mind as a child? Or as a sapling of a tree? If a child, a child is in the beginning, needs training, right? He or she is a little uncontrollable. May run off every once in a while, this way, that way. Do things that are not nice. Push a child in the playground. Hit someone with a stick. And what do we tell the child? Don't do it. Right? Do we ever go to the child and say, it's okay, you haven't hit someone with a stick in a long time. You need to release every once in a while. Right? Just release. It's okay. You know, choose one kid out of the playground once a month and release your frustrations. No, it's unacceptable behavior. It happens every once in a while, but you can get over that. Why? By proper training, by proper guidance. Don't do this. Don't do this. Some combination of kind words and sometimes a little threat. Right? And okay, the child learns, and a couple times a mistake happens, and after a while you train not to do it again. Is the child repressed their whole life? That, oh my God, I just have this urge to hit someone in the playground, and I couldn't do that as a child? Well, usually not. Right? Usually not, no. It's these things can be worked through, they can be worked out through proper training. So we should think of the mind as a child, as a sapling that grows crooked sometimes, but can be trained to grow straight. That tree which has been trained to grow straight doesn't suffer its whole life because it's been trained to grow straight. No, that's it becomes its natural position. It becomes constitutional. So we shouldn't succumb to this idea that, you know, people often, especially in relation to things like celibacy, people think of it in that way, that, oh, it's, or in any kind of thing, actually, that, oh, repression is very bad. Yes, it can't be artificial, but the point is, training is important. If we fail, and we're going to talk about fall down a little bit later, as I mentioned, but if we fail, then that's okay. It's not the end of the world. We don't beat ourselves into the ground for it. We don't destroy ourselves because we failed. No, that's normal. Right? But so is trying not to do it again. So is the process of not justifying our mistakes and saying, it's okay, everyone does it, and this is natural, and I need to release every once in a while anyway. Right? I'm a good devotee, but once a month a good movie won't hurt. No, okay. We all release in some way or another. But we see that as a means of training, not as some kind of a natural necessity. So, creating these kinds of boundaries for ourselves, these limitations, is actually a very healthy thing. It can be a very healthy thing if it's done in a measured way and in a gradual process. Obviously, if you take a child and you shackle him to the ground and say, you're not going to move and you're going to learn how to sit quietly and listen, right, and put duct tape over its mouth, that's not healthy. Right? But a process of gradual training is very healthy. This time, the child sat for 5 minutes. Next time, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. By the time he or she is 7 or 8 or 10 years old, they can sit through a whole hour's worth of class. That type of training, creating those boundaries for ourselves, can actually be a very healthy thing. It is a very healthy process. And those types of boundaries, those types of limitations, far from harming us, they protect us. They're so crucial to our life because they protect us. By having those boundaries for ourselves, by having those boundaries in society, by taking those vows which create those boundaries, we protect ourselves. Just like when we take initiation from a spiritual master, we make a commitment. We're not going to eat meat, fish, or eggs. We're not going to engage in illicit sex, gambling, or take any kind of intoxicants. We make a vow, a commitment. Now, it does happen that we slip, we fall. In fact, not only does it happen, but it's practically inevitable at some point in our spiritual life. Because that's the reason we took the vow. is because there was potential for failure. Why would you need to take a vow if you were perfect already, if there was no potential for failure? No, it happens. It's okay. But those vows, they protect us. By making a vow, we're able to go out into a situation that may not be very conducive or helpful for ourselves, and we're able to say, no, I've made a commitment to someone. I'm not gonna go through this. Right? Like someone who's been through a period of intoxication, who's been a former alcoholic or something. By making that kind of vow, by making that commitment in front of the spiritual master, in front of other devotees, in front of a community, it protects that person. When they do enter a situation where it might be difficult, then that vow protects them. Vows, boundaries, they help protect us. They help guide us in life. They're actually a very, very great blessing. Take a look at marriage vows, for example. The vows that a husband and wife take at the marriage altar or around the sacred fire. A commitment to always stick with each other. Regardless of what culture you're looking at, there's some form of a commitment there. Through thick and thin. In health and sickness. In every situation. That vow they make, that commitment they make to each other, protects us. It protects us in that relationship. When a man goes into a particular situation, or a woman, suppose someone's traveling in a different part of the country, or is spending long periods of time away from home, the possibility of temptation is there for everyone. Who cannot succumb to temptation? No, everyone, that possibility is there. But what protects us? Because we go into that situation knowing, no, I've made a commitment. I've taken a vow. I've created a boundary for myself. And that boundary actually gives a lot of relief. It gives a lot of security that I know where I can tread and where I cannot. Any kind of boundary in life, whether it's marriage vows or friendship vows or vows to the spiritual master, they all have this very crucial role of guiding us, of protecting us. And therefore, they're sacred. Therefore, they cannot be crossed. They should not be crossed. This is why all of society is meant to help us in order to maintain those vows. This is the purpose of social structure. This is the purpose of community. It's the main purpose is just to help us keep those vows, to keep those commitments. Because they're so crucial to a satisfying human life. So this is what Rupa Goswami is describing here. He's asking us to create boundaries in our life. To create vows, to create limitations. Not because this is going to oppress us, not because our life is going to become constricted, but because this is actually what gives us freedom. Someone who's taken these vows can actually venture into any circumstance without fear, because they know that they're protected by the power of their vows. They're protected by the power of their commitments. Why is initiation such a powerful thing? Because the spiritual master's blessing is there. How is that blessing manifest? In the form of the commitment that we make to the spiritual master. That commitment protects us. And we can venture into a circumstance without fear. Again, continuing with our theme of Hanumanji. And look at him. Where he could venture without fear. Into a whole den of rakshasas. Places where no one else would dare to tread. Why? Because he was protected. He was protected by his determination, by his vows. There's a beautiful scene in the Sundar Kanda, in this section of the Ramayana, when Hanuman is jumping across the ocean to Lanka, and he lands there, he arrives there, and he starts looking for Mother Sita. He's never seen Mother Sita. He doesn't know what she looks like. And so he's looking for, based on descriptions that he's heard, that she's the most beautiful woman in this world, appearing like the goddess of fortune herself, and
She's dedicated to Lord Ramachandra and so forth. And he starts off right at the heart of Lanka, in Ravana's palace. And he's kind of making his way through the palace. And there in Ravana's palaces, he finds so many beautiful women, all fast asleep. This is the middle of the night. All fast asleep, fell asleep doing various things. Someone was playing instruments, someone was eating, different things. It was a whole kind of, basically a party scene. Right? And everyone kind of conked out at the end of it. Mm-hmm. And he's going through all of this, and he sees many, many beautiful women, and who fit the description of Mother Sita in one way or another. But gradually he eliminates each one of them, because he thinks she would never sleep on a comfortable bed in the house of Ravana. From what I've heard of Mother Sita, she could never do such a thing. But anyway, as he's looking through and seeing all these women, he starts feeling a little guilty at one point. And he says, you know, I'm a brahmachari. And here I am, going through the private rooms of another man, observing them while they're fast asleep, in various states of undress. This isn't morally right. I'm not supposed to be here. And he starts feeling very guilty, very unsure, and very worried, as a brahmachari should in that circumstance. But then, very quickly after that, the Ramayana describes this. He reminds himself, he says, yes, that's true, but in this situation, there's nothing morally wrong. And the main reason he gives for that, two reasons he says. Number one, I'm on a mission. I have a specific goal here. I'm not here for myself. And number two, when I observe myself, I don't feel any kind of disturbance as a result of seeing all of this. I'm not excited or disturbed in any way. And therefore, I know that my motivation is not impure. I'm not committing any sin as a result. In other words, he was a brahmachari, right? What protected him as he went through the most beautiful harem, or how do you pronounce the word? I don't know. Harem. In this world, harem. Right? In this world. Lanka, Ravana. Beautiful women from all over this world who he had kidnapped and they had accepted his offer to sleep with him. What protected him in that circumstance? The power of his vow, his ratta, as a brahmachari. Vacho vegam manasa krodhavi jifa vegam udarapattami. Now, here's the point. These six principles, controlling the urges, what do they mean in practice? That'll be different based on who we are and what our circumstances. What does it mean to control the urges of the genitals? What does it mean to control the urges of the tongue? There's no blanket answer. There's no one-size-fits-all answer for that. That depends on our particular situation or circumstance. Every ashrama, every social position, has its specific vows that protect the members of that ashrama. So a brahmachari takes a certain vow, no association with the opposite sex, for anything but purely business purposes, like Hanuman was going on. That vow is defined in a particular way. It means what? That anytime there's potential for that relationship to go in any direction but purely business, then I need to extract myself from that situation. Controlling those urges for the grihastha, they don't mean the same thing. They're different. The vows of the grihastha are very different. They're equally powerful and equally difficult. And they will protect the grihastha equally as they would a brahmachari. But those vows manifest in a different way. Clearly, a lack of emotional connection with the opposite sex is not going to work for the grihastha. And when a grihastha tries to pursue the vows of a brahmachari in his or her ashram, that's a recipe for failure. It's a recipe for a lot of problems. If we try to enter grihastha life saying, I'm going to be a brahmachari, and you exist, right? You're my wife, but you stay in that ashram, I'll stay in this ashram, and we'll see each other once a month. No, that's not going to work. Right? That's not what the grihastha's vow is all about. Grihastha's vow, though, is equally difficult. Yes, you're going to make an emotional commitment, you will get involved with the opposite sex, but you are not allowed to let go of that emotional commitment. Whereas a brahmachari is not allowed to make it, a grihastha is not allowed to let go. And that's the difficulty of grihastha life. Okay? Sticking through that commitment till the very end. Saying that no through thick or thin. This is not something that's dispensable. We've entered into a sacred contract. This is done in front of the spiritual master, in front of Krishna. And it's just as important as our initiation vows. Just as important. And then a sannyasi's vows. A sannyasi's vows allow a sannyasi, a renunciate, can walk away from any circumstance without guilt. That's the privilege of sannyas life. That it doesn't matter what circumstance you find yourself in, you're welcome to turn your face and work the other way. Sannyas is the position of a civil dead man. Means you're socially dead. This is what the Shastra described. And although we don't do this in Vaishnava sannyas, but in other forms of sannyas, the sannyasi will go to the bank of the Ganges and perform their own cremation ceremony. They'll perform their own funeral rites because they are now dead. Right? Dead to society. So that's the beauty, that's the privilege, that's the freedom of sannyas. That sure, you can get involved in giving advice to others. Sure, you can get involved in doing something or another in this world. But the minute you don't like it, turn around and walk away. And no one can blame you for anything. Because you're dead. You're a civil dead man. But with that privilege comes a very great vow. A very great vow. A vow of celibacy, of poverty for your entire life, of homelessness. If you're willing to take that vow, you'll be protected by it and you can enjoy the privileges that come with that vow, namely complete freedom. A grihastha doesn't have that privilege. Turning around, walking away from a situation is a sin for a grihastha. The whole point of grihastha life is to take responsibility in our communities, in our societies. Responsibilities that are directed towards our family, but also beyond that, to the community in general. That's the role of grihastha life. We don't have the privilege of walking away. But we have other privileges, like the comfort of home, right? A nice bed to come back to after a hard day's work. A sannyasi doesn't have that comfort. A sannyasi comes home to a different bed every night. There's no home. Okay? Comes to a different bed every night. Making an emotional connection with someone is a very difficult thing because you're constantly on the move. For grihastha, it's a very easy thing. When you need a shoulder to cry on, there's someone there. If you have a desire to protect, to care for others, you can in a very direct way. Right? So the point is, every ashram, every position in life, every situation we find ourselves in comes with certain privileges and certain vows that go along with us. And if we follow those vows properly, I'm just speaking in terms of ashrams, but one could say this in terms of relationships, a mother or a father or a child, or in terms of employment, right? Every relationship will come with certain commitments. We pursue those commitments. We create those boundaries for ourselves. We control those urges as and in the way that's required for that position, and you can reap the benefits in a wonderful way. That's the point here of this verse. This is not some blanket all prescription to put the lid on a pressure cooker. No, that's not the idea here. Everyone come and just squelch your desire. No, everyone has to do it in a different way, depending on their circumstance. Okay. Now, because we're coming to the close of our first session, I want to give a little bit of time for question and answers, because it's sometimes difficult to remember at the start of the next session. So if you have questions related to what we discussed here, then I'd be happy to take them. Yes, please.
You made a last sentence that we make, the vow comes with certain privileges and, every ashram comes with certain privileges and vows that come with it, right?
Right.
And then later on you said that then we can reap the benefit in that way. Can you elaborate on the benefit?
Yeah, but the question is if I could elaborate on this point of reaping the benefits of each ashram. This was the point I was making in terms of the, by benefits, I guess I could say the pleasures or the luxuries of that ashram. That the sannyasis, the benefits of his ashram are this sense of complete freedom, this lack of guilt in doing one's activities, and the ease with which he can dedicate his time to Krishna. The grihastha life comes with its own benefits. The soft side of life, right? The comfort that one finds in home and family, the respect that one gets in society, as the satisfaction one gets as a contributing member, as of society in general. There's a very distinct joy there in giving, being a contributing member of one's community. Brahmacharya life itself comes with its own benefits. One important benefit is a relative freedom from the necessity to plan for responsibility. A brahmachari, in the strict sense of the term, is completely under the guidance of someone else, under the order of someone else, very much a shishya. And so a brahmachari's life is very simple. It's simple in a way that even a sannyasi's life isn't, because he doesn't even have to manage his own life. A brahmachari's life is just do as you're told. Right? I was once listening to a class by Pankajangi Prabhu from Mayapur, one of ISKCON's most wonderful brahmacharis. And he was giving a talk to other brahmacharis. And they said, you know, please give us some advice for brahmachari ashram. And he said, it's very simple. He said, just do as you're told. And they said, well, what if you have a desire to do a particular service, like you want to pursue a project or whatever? And he was like, yeah, you could do that. Maybe go to your superiors and ask them if this would be useful or whatever. But just do as you're told. It's the privilege of the grihastha to take on a project, to start it and to pursue it, and then to deal with the consequences of it. Right? Brahmachari has to deal with very few consequences. But a grihastha has to deal with every consequence of his or her actions. So there's certain privileges and certain responsibilities that come with each of our positions in life. In terms of spiritual benefits, the benefits of sannyasa ashram are very clear. Because of the position of detachment, it's much easier to focus one's time and energy 100% on Krishna service. But grihastha life comes with its own privileges for spiritual life as well. Namely this point of protection that comes. Prabhupada describes in one place how, you know, we always think that the husband protects the wife. This is a fact. And this is the vow that the husband takes in Vedic marriage, to protect the wife. But it's also very important to remember that the wife protects the husband in very important ways. By being committed to one's wife, it protects you in this world and allows you to move in places that the other three ashramas cannot. This is why it's so much easier for grihasthas to guide others in many ways, in a very personal way, in a way that sannyasis cannot or should not, because it becomes dangerous for their own spiritual lives. You see? A sannyasi can be very dangerous to get involved at a certain level with people. Grihasthas, it's not so much a problem because they have protection. And therefore, there are certain verses in the Bhagavatam where it describes grihastha life as a boat for crossing over this ocean of material world. Because you can do it in kind of a protected way. It's easier. You're not on an inner tube on your own in the middle of the river. Right? You've got a raft, you've got other people there. It's a little fortified. So yes, it moves slower, and yes, there's, you know, more cooperation required and so forth. But there's also a certain level of security that comes with it, right? So you trade some speed for some security. it's a trade-off. Right? A sannyasi gets
extremely fast speed, and sannyasa ashram is like a razor's edge. Very, very dangerous. But if you can manage it, you'll get there in no time. So, further questions? Yes,
look.
With these texts there was a different meter. How come? That's a very good question. Sanskrit has a variety of beautiful meters, and one could speak at length about those. But I'll just say here briefly that every meter conveys a particular mood, a particular spirit. The Govinda meter, for example, that we just recited, that one is called Vasanta Tilaka, which means the ornament of spring. It has a very light, very happy, joyful feel for it. Govinda Madhi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. The atmosphere is like the weather today. Live, jolly, and the cherry blossoms. And it's very nice. The meter we did later, the longer one, is Shardula Vikriditam, which means the play of a tiger. Right? So it's playful. Krishna Kirtana Gana Nartana Paro. But you can hear someone with a heavy step playing, right? Krishna Kirtana Gana. Very lively, but powerful at the same time. It's a play of a tiger, a lion, no ordinary person playing. And then the very last one we read is a very beautiful meter. It's called Mandakranta, which means slow moving, ambling along. And it has this combination of slow and fast metrical forms. So it's a very evocative meter, very kind of, not melancholy, but very deep. Just like this verse from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Naham vipro nachana rapati napi vaishyo na shudro. It begins with four long syllables. Naham vipro, and then four short ones. Nachana rapati napi vaishyo, and again slow. Napi vaishyo na shudro. Naham varni nachagrihapati na vanastho yatirva. So it's kind of this, like taking a nice walk on a summer's day. You're just kind of, you hurry up a little bit to look at something, then you amble along. No rush, and kind of a little bit directionless as well. And sometimes, so poets will choose a different meter when the mood changes, when they want to highlight something specifically. Just like if you look in Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 11, when the universal form is shown, right, the meter changes. It goes from this regular meter, Dharma Kshetre, Kuru Kshetre, to this Deva Deva Jagatpate, and it becomes this, a longer meter of 11 verses. It signals that something's happening here. Right? A momentous occasion is taking place. Notice also in the second chapter of the Gita, when Arjuna is having his breakdown. He's just had his breakdown. Krishna said a few verses. And then that momentous occasion arrives in text 7 of chapter 2, when Arjuna finally surrenders to Krishna. And he says, okay, I've had enough of trying to figure this out myself. I'm your disciple. And at that moment, the meter changes. Darpanya dosho pahata swabhava prichami tvam dharma samudacheta. Right? So it signals that, okay, something has happened. Something's different. The emotion has changed. And poets will often use these meters to great effect in order to evoke certain moods, certain feelings. So the fact that the very last verse about Srimati Radharani is in Mandakranta meter, this very evocative meter, is no coincidence. That Rupa Goswami is a wonderful poet, and he knows how to use these meters just properly. Of course, our ability to appreciate them is limited because he's writing for an audience which practically doesn't exist anymore today. Such a sophisticated, like I said, sophisticated people and sophisticated audience, and our ability to appreciate poetry is limited. But to some extent, we still can. Right? We can appreciate the beauty of the language. So, nice question. Yes, please.
So you started off by reading the first verse, which you said right away, if you can imbibe this verse, then you're qualified to be a spiritual master. And then you went on to talk about how the vows of the different ashrams were kind of the method of protection so that one can kind of follow these principles. So My own experience, and maybe a lot of people's, is that, you know, sometimes when the difficulties manifest, the vows are the last thing you're thinking about. You know, they don't even come into play at all.
Yeah.
And so my question was, is, you know, this, you know, that seems like it requires a lot of clarity of thinking and a real, you know, hold on kind of yourself. And I guess my question is, you know, especially for Western devotees, maybe, or someone like myself who had, you know, 20 years or so of their life where they were just living, you know, without any kind of regulation or any kind of, you know, advanced culture. You know, how does this come into play, and how are we supposed to reconcile this? Because it seems like it's all great advice, but sometimes it seems way beyond even, you know.
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's an excellent question. I think the answer to your question is kind of embedded in the question itself. Because you tied it to this point of we become a guru at the end of, if we actually can follow this verse. And actually, just as I was saying that these vows, these limitations, these caps on these urges are determined, are done according to one's ashram, so also one becomes a guru or spiritual master according to one's ashram. In other words, sometimes again we have a tendency to think of the spiritual master simply in one way, as the satguru, someone who gives initiation at the moment of diksha and puts us on the path back to Godhead. Yes, that is the most important form of a spiritual master. But the guru finds, we have to find the spiritual master in every circumstance, in every position. And so anyone who has successfully mastered these urges in their ashram is then qualified to be an ashram guru. An ashram guru. Now, this point is very important because especially in our movement, the Krishna Consciousness Movement, I think this is one of the things that we have to work on most in developing, is developing relationships with ashram gurus, people who are spiritual master in one particular way, namely in pursuing our ashram. Because someone, for example, who's kept their marriage vows for a lifetime, been through the ups and downs and the slips and falls, and come out the other end as in the way that Rupa Goswami described, is therefore qualified to be a guru, to be an ashram guru, to guide grihasthas who are just beginning on their grihastha path. In the same way, if someone is seeking, trying to be a brahmachari, they shouldn't go to a grihastha for advice, right? The first thing the grihastha is going to try to do is get them married. This is what grihasthas enjoy doing, right? They should go to an ashram guru, someone who's been a brahmachari, and can say, this is the way you're going to maintain that ashram. This is how you're going to do it. Right? So, I guess my point is that you're right. It's very, very difficult to actually do these in practice. It's not just for Western devotees or for Indian devotees or for, depending on background, for everyone. We all have our weak spots. And if you go through these list of six, I bet if we each went through these lists of six, we could at least find one or two that were specifically problematic for us. Right? We've got our weak spots and we struggle with them. And yes, the vows do become very difficult to maintain, or they might not even come into our consideration. This is why we need a relationship with an ashram guru. This is why we need a relationship with a guru in every aspect of our life. Because there has to be someone who can say, look, hold on, you can't do that, right? What are you thinking? Is this really what you want to do? Or who can encourage us when we're feeling a little down or a little weak and say, look, you'll get through this. This is not the first time anyone's been through this. I went through the same thing myself. And it's okay, it's normal. It just, for example, my wife and I were looking forward to our first child soon. And having a first child, becoming pregnant for the first time, the prospect of becoming a father or mother, it's a whole different view of the world, a whole different situation. And if we didn't have the guidance of people who had been through pregnancy before, right, it'd be so difficult, nearly impossible, right, to get through. Because there are so many things that you think, this is the first time it's ever happened in the history of the world and it's happening to me. In fact, this happened just a couple days ago. And then we spoke to someone, a good friend, on the phone, and she said, no, I've I've been through many of these, and this is the way it happens to everyone, and you better get used to it. Right? And immediately, a big sense of relief. So encouragement at times when we're feeling down. Perhaps a little reprimand when we're consciously becoming lax, misstepping. Or a little wake-up call when we've fallen asleep. Those are the type of things that it becomes so important to have a relationship with a guru for, an ashram guru. And this is why we have to try to broaden our guru-disciple relationships as far as possible. In every sphere of life, find a guru who's good at doing that. Someone who you can trust and build a long-term relationship with. Because, I mean, I can say for myself, in my academic service, if I didn't have the guidance of mentors, it's so, so difficult. I mean, who knows what could happen as a result? Even though I have wonderful guidance in terms of how to pursue my sadhana and my spiritual life, even though I have wonderful guidance in terms of how to be a grihastha, but if I didn't have guidance in how to pursue my academic work, then that could be the cause of great problems, of fall down in one of these ways. You see what I mean? So that's what we have to do, is diversify our relationships with individuals. Because the only way to get to the point at the end of this verse of becoming guru, becoming adept in this area, is to have relationships with people who've done that themselves. And this is the whole point of Guru Parampara. Otherwise, you're right. It's very difficult. When we're in that situation, it's very difficult to see beyond it. Okay, I think, yes, do you have a...
Yes.
Yes, please. Okay.
I was going to say, in the six urges we described, five of them I can relate to quite easily, you know, Vajrayoga, but controlling the mind, that one just seems a little abstract, you know. Yeah, there's a more, can you just elaborate on maybe right. What Rupa Goswami is referring to? Or
yeah, okay. That's a very good question. Let me just ask you, since you're also kind of the organizer here, how long should we go? Because we have lunch on schedule, and the urge of the belly is... My urge to speak and your urges of the belly. We don't want to have a contest here. This is more powerful, right? It doesn't work out very well.
5:10.
Okay, so... Let's say we worked about 12:15, okay, 15 minutes extra, and then so last question. The urges of the mind. This is of course a huge topic, but one thing that comes to mind. The primary urge of the mind, okay, at least here in terms of how it's described by our acharyas in commentaries on Nectar of Instruction, tends to be the attachments that the mind has. In fact, most of the other problems of the mind are a product of attachment. They're born of attachment. Krishna speaks of this in the Bhagavad Gita. Vita raga bhaya krodha, he says. That giving up, becoming free of these three urges of raga, bhaya, and krodha. Attachment, fear, and anger in chapter 4 of Bhagavad Gita. And in fact, there's a progression here. Attachment leads very easily, naturally, to fear. Because when you have something, you're afraid of losing it. Okay? When you don't have something, but you're attached to the idea of having it, then you're afraid of not getting it. And if you don't get it, or if you get and lose it, then that leads to krodha, or anger. So it's kind of a pattern here, attachment. So attachment is kind of the key, it's the crux in terms of the mind's problem. Now, getting rid of attachment, there's the whole process of Krishna consciousness about that. That's so many things one could say. But just in keeping with what we've been discussing so far, let's continue in that thought process. The Varnashram system, these stages of life, these vows that we've been discussing, a wonderful effect of these vows, part of the purpose of these vows, is that they lead to gradual detachment. They lead to a loosening of our material attachments and a strengthening of our attachments for Krishna. The idea is that, for example, you spend a lifetime as a grihastha, doing your job, taking care of family, taking care of kids, fulfilling your material desires within the bounds allowed by scripture. If you do this according to dharma, not in a wild way, according to what scriptures prescribe, then it is almost inevitable that by the time you come to a conclusion of your grihastha life, in other words, comes to a close, the children are grown up, and we've reached a certain age and so forth, that a certain form of detachment from that ashram and from the entanglements of that ashram will arise. And I've seen this in many instances of my superiors, ways in which the urgency with which you do things in grihastha life, those things don't become urgent anymore. Other things become more important. And there's a certain sense of distance and attachment that naturally develops, that should develop, in fact, the scriptures say. If it doesn't, then you're setting yourself up for problems. If we decide to continue to stay as hands-on and micromanaging of our lives and our children's lives till the very end, then it's a recipe for frustration. We see this in scripture, we see this from personal life examples. So grihastha life is meant, there's an element of trust here, that the scriptures describe this, others have done it. If we pursue the dharma, the vows of our ashram properly, then at the end of that, we will become detached. The mind will be peaceful. I've been there, I've done that. I've seen it all. Yes, you go through it. It's a good thing. But as for me, it's enough. Right? Like, you know, just think about something you were really, for example, doing your PhD. Right? This was like getting an education. 10 years straight, nonstop, without any semester off. From a BA to a master's to a PhD. At that time, it was exciting. It was enthusiastic. Like, we wanted to do this. Got it. And now, thinking back, I can't imagine doing that over again. Right? If someone said, do another PhD, no way. Right? Exhausted. I've had it. Right? And at that time, I was experiencing real pleasure. It was like, you know, there was a certain passion involved in getting it done. But now, at least that passion is satiated. Now, there's other passions on the horizon. But the point is, we have to trust scripture, that if we go through the stages of life properly and we pursue our vows and our dharma for that particular stage, that attachment will gradually work its way through. And the mind will become peaceful. It'll calm down. It'll become less agitated. So it's a gradual process. We have to strive for it, but it's not going to happen overnight. The mind is not going to let go of it. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention in this first part and for your wonderful questions. We look forward to seeing you again after lunch, Prasad.